Stuntstruck. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Vanessa, over the years, there's been a couple of name changes, and you carried two names, Vanessa Cater, and what's the latest one you're going with on social media? It's
It's just Vanessa Cater. My Facebook that you know me from is my private one. So
I have another one.
Yes. So Vanessa Cater is my actual name. So and that's on my Twitter, my Instagram, and my fan page that someone else started up and then gave me admin of after they started it up for me. But it's all Vanessa Cater across the board. And then there's my private one, which is the other name, which is just because it's for friends and family.
So everybody, just a little bit on Vanessa. You know, she's been brought up in the entertainment industry. Her father was a stand-up comedian and a hypnotist. So she was on stage from 5 to 14 years old as a magician. There you go. Sadly, mum died at the age of 12 from breast cancer. You know, that's a big one for us in New Zealand. You know, we've lost a lot of our good people to that. And she started acting at 14, and apparently it was all that she ever wanted to do. Look at her now. She got into stunts 11 years ago, and she worked with some people that are mutual friends. One, Dana, who introduced you to the stunt community. And she asked you to consider stunts, and it took about 3 years to finally do it on a show called Legend of the Seeker. And then she went on to work on shows like Ash vs. Evil Dead. Spartacus been a significant show, and she made some great contacts with that. And it was during that time that she decided to try the LA thing. And better to try and fail than not, and always wonder, boy, have I said that to myself. 6 years, a green card later, finally making a headway over there. But damn, she did struggle, she said to me privately. And hey, Vanessa, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, so tell us, where did it all begin? You know, those early years with your dad. You know, I noticed on Facebook, you know, that he's the supportive dad still. You know, he's still his little girl. Just tell us about those early years. How it all started for you?
My dad, I mean, he still performs around the world. He was actually meant to be, if it wasn't for COVID, he was actually meant to be here doing hypnotism shows. He had one in Salem. He had two shows in Disneyland. So he's still a pretty, you know, prevalent performer around the world, which is great. But when I was little, he was actually a kids entertainer. And he used to have a character that he performed under called Happy the Hobo. And he would dress in these like badges and top hat and tails, like an old suit with patches and badges all over it. And about, so the story goes, so my dad tells it, I climbed onto his lap at the age of 5 and went, Daddy, you know how you're a magician and your name is Happy the Hobo? I could be your magician's assistant and be Happiness. So, because everyone calls me Ness. So it was Happiness. So that was my stage name for many, many years when I was little. And I started performing, and actually that was my you know, part-time job while other people were off at supermarkets and, you know, doing other stuff. I was performing magic shows at like St. Luke's Mall and the Henderson Square, and, you know, back when Foot Rock Flats days were around in New Zealand, I was performing there. So it was really fun. It was a really fun way to be introduced to the entertainment industry, you know.
What is your father's name? So everybody out there, watch out for this name here.
Oh,
your dad's name?
His name's Guy, G-U-Y, Cater. Yeah.
There you go. Well, Guy Cater, watch that space, everybody. And I'm sure that space is well filled. And so from there, you know, you took up acting at 14. What was that something that was always in the cards right from when you were doing magic with your dad to get into acting?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to be an actor my whole life, I think. I can't recall ever not wanting to perform and be an actor. So when I was 14, there was a show, an American show being shot in New Zealand called High Tide. And it had George Segal in it, and I went along to a casting agency and joined, and they needed featured extras. And so at 14 years old, I looked a lot older because of my height. I was already almost 5'10" at that age. They cast me as like this, you know, pretty LA executive girl who was like sitting there swooning over George Segal while he played a banjo. And that was my first proper featured extra work that I did. And I did many, many years of that while I was at high school and stuff like that, which much to the teacher's disapproval, because I took a lot of time off. But my dad always said to me, if this is what you want to do with your life, then you should really pursue that. So it didn't matter how much school I missed out on if I was pursuing what I wanted to do with my life. Thank God I came to Hollywood, or else he would have been.
Wow. Well, I remember High Tide. I was just new to the business, and I remember it was had a lot of action in it. I set up a zip line where we had Rick Springfield's stunt double zip line across two buildings in Auckland City, and people jumping off Hunua Falls. It was massive. You know, I was just green to the business, and here I was watching this action take place. So there you go. That's how we first met, but not on the same day on set, obviously.
Oh, probably not, but that's amazing. You're the only other person that I've ever talked to that I brought that show up to who actually even remembers what it was.
And I think that might have been the show that I did my first on-screen performance. I think I played a Mexican security guard and got beaten by this blonde. It's been the start of a career, really, of being beaten by blondes. So there you go.
Well, you know, as a relative blonde in the industry, we appreciate you.
Hey, and so you went to school, obviously. And so what happened? Did you pursue it? Did you do formal training as an actress? Was that like when you were at school, did you pursue the usual do drama, school plays, or were you getting enough of that outside of school?
No, I look, here's the thing, you know, with New Zealand education, it's a lot different, especially back then versus like an American education, which where everyone, you know, has to go to university or, you know, college or whatever it is. In New Zealand, when I was at school, there was seventh form or bursary, which was your introduction into university. And I knew that I wasn't going to go to university because there was nothing there that I wanted to study, because acting and drama wasn't really so much a big thing back then. It is now, but not then. And so after sixth form, which is the second to last year of schooling, I auditioned. You're meant to be 18 to get into a performing arts course, the Selwyn Performing Arts. And I was 16 and I went along and auditioned, and they gave me early acceptance to get in. So I did the performing arts. It was in sort of 18 month diploma. And I was 16 turning 17 when I went in, and then 18 when I got out. And again, they weren't really a huge fan of me because you're not meant to still pursue actual work while you're studying, and I was one of those no. And so I, you know, sadly went off and took a lot of time off to do work, which, you know, I was a stroppy teenager. I'm still a stroppy, but not a teenager. But yeah, I mean, but it's, you know, it was a great way to sort of now looking back, I'm very grateful for the time that I had there. I probably, now that I'm older and I'm an adult, I would definitely invest more of my energy into that. But it was a great start to realize how in depth the crossover between theatre and TV and film and voice coaching and how much goes into it. And I definitely have an appreciation of that through that. But then when I came to LA, I really invested in acting classes, and I was doing comedy and audition workshops, and I was going to probably three classes a week for the first few years that I was here. And boy, does that drain a bank account.
Wow. And so, so it's so that you're you spent your 20s basically as an actress, is that correct? Because when I first met you in the stunt business, you were, you know, I think you were getting to that next decade of your life, I guess, fair to say. And
we don't talk about that. Yeah, you're right.
But, it's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, New Zealand is so small. And, you know, I remember doing a TV commercial, and I think it's the only time that I've actually ever been on set with you and somebody pointed you out. And I said, oh, great, we've got all these people that I don't know. And the next thing I heard from people that you would, that's right, I was I asked of you while I was doing the show, and somebody said that you had gone to LA. And that's, we live in the day of social media, and I think we got friended about the same time and kind of realized, and I've been following your journey from afar. And with interest. So what was the, tell us the pathway that led you to LA, and why LA, you know, the world's your oyster, why this particular place?
I think it was just, you know, the dream that I had as a young girl wanting to pursue acting in the Hollywood dream and the land of opportunity, and, you know, growing up, you know, idolizing LA in America. I mean, you know, when you're not from America, that's what you do. You do see the glitz and the glam, and, you know, it was one of those things that I just always wanted to do. And I just, getting here was seeing the opportunity in front of me, seeing that it was something that I could possibly try for. It seems silly to not grab it. It didn't matter if it didn't work out. I had a great life in New Zealand, and I could always go back to that. I have friends and family, and New Zealand's not going anywhere. And if I didn't try, even if I failed, to have never tried when it was something that I dreamed of my whole life and the opportunity was there, to not grab it just seems so silly. So that's why I did it. But getting here, I am so grateful for the stunt community and doing stunts. Not only do I love it, because being on set, regardless of acting or stunts, being on set is my favorite place to be. When we were talking earlier, I said that I'm a night owl. The only time that I spring out of bed at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning is when I have a call time to get to. And man, I jump up. I don't care if I've only had an hour's sleep. I'm so excited to go to work every single day, even if my body hurts and I'm bruised. I want to show off my bruises on set and be like, did you see what I did yesterday? Look at us. You know, it's so exciting to me. And I still feel that way after all these years. And stunts was my platform to be able to come over here. And New Zealand's such an amazing place where people will encourage and train you up. And Dana was such a big stepping stone for that for me, because she was always so encouraging and supportive. So besides the commercial that we worked on, which was my first ever job, the Toshiba commercial that we talked about, that was my first ever stunt job. After that, I went to work on Legend of the Seeker, the American production that was being shot in New Zealand. And I was working with Dana, and there were a lot of new girls who had come into the industry, because there'd been such a big gap after Lord of the Rings and Xena and Hercules that a lot of the established women had moved on to get other jobs or had young kids and stuff like that. Near availability wasn't around as much. And so they brought in like this fresh crew of girls into the industry. But we, as much as a bunch of us had some raw talent and professionalism on set, we were raw and we hadn't had any training. And I remember talking to Dana about maybe her doing some workshops and how all of us girls had talked about it and we would love some training, because, you know, we knew that we needed it. To get training on set was incredible, and that's what New Zealand's fantastic for, but it is much better to turn up already having some idea of what you're doing, so that, you know, so that you're not wasting everyone's time on set, because you can't rely on that training. You either do it or you don't. And so Dana then started up the New Zealand Stunt School after doing a few workshops with us girls. So now there's that in New Zealand, which has grown from, you know, a bunch of, you know, us new people starting up. So from Legend of the Seeker, I went to Spartacus and made some great friends, and then worked on The Hobbit really briefly. And once you acquire some of those credits, with, you know, big names attached to it, regardless of the amount of work that you did, applying for a work visa in America strangely wasn't that hard once you paid for a good lawyer. So once I got here, I got my work visa, and then I came over. That's when the real struggle started, because it's starting from scratch all over again. No one cares. No one cares what you've done. If you haven't worked for the coordinators or you don't have any contacts in America, it doesn't matter. You need to hustle. And it took me a long time to figure out what that meant and the amount of energy and time and confidence that it took to be able to do that.
And how did how does networking go when you're coming in? You know, you obviously you had your contacts. When did you actually, what happened to you made you feel like, oh, this is what I need to do? Was anybody in particular, was there a specific group that you went to see? How does that work in terms of, you didn't sit at a cafe waiting, going, is anybody there, stuntman, stuntman? I mean, what happened? Did you go knocking on people's doors, or do you...
Well,
just explain that, because I'm fascinated.
Yeah, the thing that I find really interesting is in New Zealand, this was a huge hurdle. It took me, and I honestly have to say, years to break down the New Zealand stunt culture to the American stunt culture. In New Zealand, if you were to just rock up on set with your headshot and ask if you could talk to the stunt coordinator, chances are they're going to take your headshot and be like, great, now I know who to never ever hire. You know, because if you've just rocked up without any friends or anything like that onto a location or a set, you probably won't ever work again. Whereas over here, they expect you to do that. They expect you to find out when they're shooting on location where it's not a closed set, turn up and be able to walk up to a stunt coordinator and be like, hustle your way onto set and hand over your headshot and be like, hey. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying. So, yeah, a lot of people try and like lie their way onto set. The great thing about having a Kiwi accent is I turned up and I'd say to the PAs or the ADs, hey, I'm just here to hustle the stunt coordinator. Some of the boys told me that they were shooting today and that it'd probably be okay to come down. And they'd be like, oh, sure, we'll take you up there. And they would escort me up there, which was amazing. Because everyone else is like, how did you get on? I'm like, I told the truth. It works for me. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, let me just backtrack there. So, okay, now I have to ask for forgiveness here. So you were actually on The Hobbit, because I was a coordinator on that.
Yeah, it was the Lake Town Village stuff. It was in it was doing the Lake Town Village stuff
We burnt it.
No, in the actual lake when everyone was like drowning and we were getting pulled out of the lake and everyone was doing all the ocean stuff.
I see. Gotcha.
Yeah, so it was when we were, I just remember, Shane Runge and Shane Dawson, both in like 2-degree water, laying face down, shot after shot after shot, in wetsuits, just taking one for the team, freezing their butts off because it was the runoff from Mount Cook, and it was amazing. It was like 2 full weeks of that madness. Yeah.
Wow. I remember, I think Tim Wong was sending me pictures of you guys, and I think we were preparing the barrel sequence up in the warmer part of the island.
You were, and we were getting pictures of a whole lot of you guys up on a mountain. You guys got helicoptered to the top of a mountain on one day, and you were doing running sequences, and you had like Bronson and all those guys being dwarfs and stuff running across the top of mountains, and we're all so jealous as we're like freezing in like 30 layers of like, you know, cold stuff going, I want their job right now because it looks so spectacular.
I must say that as Kiwis, we do really well when it comes to doing some location work. You know, absolutely blessed. Wow. And so, okay. So how long have you been in LA now? So you've been here, what, 5, 6 years?
6 years. Yeah. I came December 13th, 2013, but I didn't actually get my visa until April 2014. So that's why it's a little, you know, depending on how you want to word it. But yeah, so 6 years, going on 6.5 now. And I had a work visa for the first 3 years. I applied for my green card, which was terrifying because Trump was just getting in and, you know, not allowing a lot of immigrants. And then it took a year for my green card to come in. So I worked on the last thing that I did on my work visa was in late January 2017, I think it was. And that was doing the last episode of Sleepy Hollow, the TV show. And I did the last episode of that. And then my work visa ran out. My green card had been accepted, but I didn't actually get my green card until November 2017. So the entire of 2017, I couldn't work. I couldn't leave the country. I couldn't do anything. So basically 2017 was a complete wash for me. And then by the time I got my green card, after doing an entire year of not being able to hustle, not being able to work, not being able to do anything, I felt like I was starting all over again, 2018.
Oh my goodness, is that right?
Yeah. So it was a whole thing. So by the time that rolled around, by the time basically 2018 rolled around, boy did I have a fire lit under me, because I knew that I could do anything that I wanted to because I had my green card, but I'd also been sitting doing nothing, which I feel was very good practice for the last 4 months of COVID isolation.
Hey, and one of the things that I, that we talk about, and I'd love to get your insight on it, you know, being in LA, where does the role of social media in terms of staying connected with the industry and the influence of that on getting connections and, you know, because you came into LA and of course, you know, from New Zealand, we're kind of probably very different over there. Just give us some insight into how that works there.
Social media wise, I don't know. I'm really torn on it. Like, I love my social media in the sense that, I don't know, I get to put out, like, my stories on Instagram. They go on forever. And it's me talking and chatting to people who aren't there. But I feel like it keeps me connected to the world. I get to have an opinion. Sometimes I get to play a character because, you know, I'm not doing anything else acting wise. So it's fun. I think it's great connection wise. I think it's, I think that way you can actually, it gives you access to people. You can, you know, you can see who's friends of friends and things like that. And I definitely have made a few contacts via social media for sure. I still think that as much as you can showcase things on social media, you still need to, as an actor or a stunt performer or anyone in the industry, you still need to do other groundwork. People aren't going to find you on their own. I've got like 21,000 followers on Instagram. And to be honest, it's never, you know, no, that's not true. It has gotten me work. Just not to the level that most people think that it has. The groundwork of finding a coordinator's email, sending your reel, contacting them in real life, touching base, going to friends of friends' houses for dinner and making those contact with people so they know that you're a real human being and that they can stand you for more than 2 seconds is really, really important. So I think social media is a great networking tool. But I also think that it is still not it's not the groundwork. It is something to keep you current and active and in people's minds. And if you've got content, like as a stunt performer of you working, it's great for people to see, oh, great. Oh, I didn't realize I did that. Oh, that was them. That's so awesome. That was me watching previs and stuff for The Old Guard with Charlize Theron that just came out on Netflix. And I didn't know a bunch of my friends who worked on the previs. I was like, oh, wow. Social media is fantastic for that. But again, nothing beats groundwork.
Wow. And so, because my experience of LA, I mean, you're either an actor or a stunt man or woman. I mean, I mean, what are you? I mean, you've trained as an actress, so you've trained as a, you've been a stunt woman. So how does that work? I mean,
are you born? I'm still trying to figure that out. it's interesting. I think it's really funny. In New Zealand for the first, 12, four, whatever years that I was an actor, I would audition for casting people as an actor. It was interesting. The minute I got into doing stunts and I started working on some of these noted shows doing stunts, my agent, my same agent that I'd had the entire time, all of a sudden was getting responses back from casting agents going, but she's a stunt girl, not an actor, and this is a strong guest role or a reoccurring, but she's just a stunt girl. And she was like, that happened a year ago. What are you talking about? So there is sometimes you come up against that issue. I love doing both. So for me, more often than not, I get stunt acting roles. So I'm 5'10". I'm a little bit more Amazonian. So getting me to double someone is a little harder because there aren't many girls my size who are actors to double. Where my difference comes into play that's great for me is if they want someone who's the boss bitch, Amazonian, kick-ass warrior, kind of Viking thing, which is all the roles that I ever get, then quite often people do say, oh, we know this girl, she's great. And they'll be like, well, can she act as well? Because it's kind of like we need someone who can do action, but they need to be able to say a line. They need to be able to portray a character. And they're like, yeah, she's actually an actor. So for me, it's worked well, but I still come up against, in both regards, some issues. Since I came to America, I think most of the stunt coordinators here who I work with know that I can hold my own doing stunts, which is fantastic. It's then convincing them that I'm actually a decent actor and that I can do an American accent, kind of. So that they can then put me forward for those roles as well. And that is always a very interesting challenge. More and more of the younger coordinators, and when I say younger coordinators, not necessarily in age, but in the coordinators who have gotten into coordinating probably over the last 10 years, I've found are very aware how good of an actor a lot of stunt performers are. There are stunt performers who never want to say a line, and there are stunt performers who are just like, give it to me. I'm good. I can take this. This is great. And I think that there are a bunch of those coordinators out there who really push for their performers to get an audition. That's where I think the great part comes in, because then you have to audition and you're either going to get the role or you're not, because you're either going to be good enough or you're not. So I think once the battle is always trying to get the audition, and then it's up to you to do your job as an actor to be able to get the job. But getting that audition, whether you're just acting or whether you're an action actor or a stunt performer who also can sideline as an actor, getting the audition is the hard part. Doing your best once you're in there, that comes down to you.
Look, working as a coordinator, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, I've seen a great amount of requests direct from the directors to put forward stunt people who have an acting background. Yeah. You know, just I think that the way that the culture has changed, we've committed a lot more actors to action, and they're investing their time in action. And a lot of the action now requires a lot more feeling to come out through some, especially the fight sequences. And yeah. So you need stunt people to be able to carry the emotion of some of these fight sequences. So I'm finding now that I'm asking more and more stunt people to get acting classes. And especially as they get older too, because just the level of maturity that they can carry in front of the camera. Wow, that is, so okay, you've been there now, what, 6 years? Yep. You know, before the world got locked down. I mean, just what's been happening for you in the last year? Just fill us in, because I mean, this is kind of really significant time in our, in, not only on the planet, but I think for the film industry, we're watching LA, Hollywood, you know, with interest. Yeah. You know, what's been going on with you in the last year?
Well, I mean, this last year, I think I mentioned to you, has been pretty significant for me, just sort of getting people to know me and notice me and getting some work. So I think the biggest thing for me is I was actually at the point where I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to survive. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay my bills, or I was at the end of all of my savings after years. And the beautiful, wonderful Monique Ganderton, who is an amazing stunt coordinator, Canadian turned, she lives in Atlanta now. She couldn't do Jumanji, the next level, the second Jumanji. And they needed a Viking Amazonian type girl, and she went, I know the girl for you, you should look at this girl, Vanessa. Monique and I have never worked together, so this is the one time that I said social media actually worked for me. Monique and I have met a few times, but she told me she'd watched my social media, and so she knew that I could hold my own in front of the camera, which is somewhere between my vanity and my experience. So she recommended me to work on Jumanji. And I got a call from the coordinator, assistant to the coordinator, Susie. And she said, would you be able to come and do an audition for us? Because, you know, we haven't seen your work in Atlanta tomorrow, thinking that I was in Atlanta. And I went, I'm in LA. Can I send you an audition on tape? And they went, no, no, not that kind of audition. We need to work with you and fight with you and stuff. And I was like, okay, give me one moment. Called my friends, and they wanted me to work as a local as well. So, which meant that I was going to be paying for myself. So I called one of my friends, John, and I said, what's the likelihood of me getting this? He said, get your ass on a plane right now. So I found one ticket to Atlanta, which was $500 one way. It was right at the end of when I almost had no more money left. I had paid my rent, and then I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I found the money, and I got a plane flight to Atlanta. I did not sleep because of the time difference. I took an Uber from the airport to the studio at Blackhall in Atlanta, walked in with no sleep. And in about 40 minutes, I guess, Wolfie, who is the assistant, the fight coordinator, worked with me on about a 42 beat fight that they filmed and then sent to Wade Eastwood, who's the coordinator, to look at, while I sat there sweating and shaking in anticipation of going, oh God. And they were like, great, so you've got it. Can you come in to do wardrobe on Friday? And it was this Wednesday. I'm like, okay. And then I worked for 5 weeks on Jumanji 2, working with The Rock and, you know, Kevin Hart and Jack Black, who's hilarious, and doing this, working with these incredible people and making these lifelong friendships and stuff like that, and earning good money, which meant a lot to me at the time. And doing some amazing sequences and stuff like that. And also having the director come up to a few of us going, say these lines. And then I asked American or New Zealand, he went, no, do a New Zealand accent. And then gave me a couple of lines to say in the film. So I'm credited as an actor on Jumanji because my stuff made it in, which was amazing. And then I went back to LA and didn't work. So I flew myself back down to Atlanta, got down there and worked doing stunts on Black Lightning. And then they knew who I was. So they asked me to audition for an acting role, which I got. In the next episode, I got a purely co-star acting role on Black Lightning from being a stunt performer, the Masked Men audition. And then a coordinator who I'd worked with, while I was doing Jumanji, the coordinator on Doom Patrol asked if I could come in and do an episode. So we scheduled Jumanji and Doom Patrol for me to go in and work on Doom Patrol. Second season of Doom Patrol runs around and he recommends me for a purely acting role, no stunt. So I did three episodes as a reoccurring co-star on Doom Patrol as an actor with no action, just as an actor on Doom Patrol back in Atlanta again. And then while I was doing that, I get a call and I made all these amazing friends in Atlanta. And I get a call from Brad Martin, who was coordinating at the time. It's now Dave McCumber, but at the time it was Brad, going, "What are you doing next month?" And I'm like, "Why?" And he said, "We would like you to come and work with us on Falcon and the Winter Soldier for Marvel for a month, 3 months, who knows?" And I was just like, "Okay." And so basically that's been this year so far. I started in the middle of January working on Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And when you're working Marvel, all of a sudden you're like, I feel like I've made it. Although I feel like I'm learning so much. There are some incredible performers that just, I know that I'm not at that level, but damn if I'm not going to try and step up because they all recommended me. So I have to make sure that I prove them right. And we were in Prague shooting. We went from Atlanta to Prague. We had done 4 days in Prague. First time internationally working where, you know, you get flown business class. It's the first time doing any of that. And we get an email for our call times. And within 20 minutes, we get another email saying, pack your bags. This is not a drill. You are being evacuated in the morning. COVID-19, whatever. So we all got evacuated the next day. And for the last 4 months, we've been waiting to find out when we go back to finish shooting.
Wow. I'm literally holding my breath for you there. It's like, what a ride. That is insanely awesome.
It is. It's amazing. Like I'm so unbelievably grateful. And this is the networking thing that we've been talking about. It took years to build these friendships and these relationships. And I find it very interesting. A lot of people say, you know, well, what's your martial arts background? I'm like, I have to be honest. I don't have one. I have a boxing and kickboxing personal trainer dance background. And I'm like a bar brawl, you know, slam, wreck, ground pounder kind of a girl. So I take hits like boys take hits, which is awesome. I'm not getting any younger, but I'm still doing it. But those, you know, there are some so talented, skilled people with years and years of training. But the thing that made the difference to this particular group of people on Marvel is that they said that they wanted me around, which is the biggest compliment I could have ever got. And it's been positive and confidently humble, as we've spoken about before, and just being someone who's great to work with. And my whole attitude when I'm on set is absolutely, what else do you need? You know, like if I'm not working on that day and we're on set, I will clean the mats. I have no ego when it comes to that. I will ask if they want a coffee. You want me to clean your, like, you know, help the wardrobe people because shoes need cleaning. I will do that just to make myself valued and valuable. It's just what you have to do. And the great thing is that I'm a very good masseuse. So every time someone gets injured, they're coming over going, oh my God, can you fix this? Because I've got a personal training and rehab background. So I've made myself very valuable on set. Add value.
Wow. And, you know, What's your gauge on what's happening right now in Hollywood? And well, America, I mean, we all want America to do well, don't we? I mean, it's natural. What's happening there in LA, you know, with everybody being, well, and running now on first gear again, you know, it's quiet. Are you still finding time to train and stay on top of it? And are people positive about the industry getting back?
Yeah, I feel like the general consensus is everyone's itching to work again. And, you know, there's so much work out there ready to go. But everyone wants to be safe. This is a very scary time, just in regards to the fact that our job involves so much contact. And we all have to really trust each other in this particular industry. So they're being very cautious. Very, very cautious about making sure protocols are right and things like that. So once they figure that out, I think it's going to be full steam ahead. So everyone's staying quietly positive, and, you know, not the thing about it is all the work is still there. Nothing has actually gone away. If anything, once a few productions start going, I think it's going to snowball. It's just a matter of when, which is very hard to sit there sort of going, are we, no? Yeah, they've got contract? No, okay. So they're in the negotiation phase, from what I understand, for studios and things like that. I've got a few friends who are working on productions right now. I know a couple of productions have gone to Germany to shoot. So things are happening, but they've been taken away from where they were originally going to be shooting in LA or San Francisco and things like that. I think most people have... I see a lot of friends and stuff who are just out in parks. They're back doing old school training where they're, you know, shooting, you know, fights with friends. And I personally, because I've got a personal training background and I still personal train, I have a mobile PT kit. So I have a home gym in my tiny little apartment, but I've got everything that I need. So I'm managing to, I actually lost about 10 pounds in American terms since I got back from Prague, but I did eat all the crafty. So probably wasn't that hard to lose it. but yeah, everyone's really trying to stay positive. We don't really know what's happening as of yet. Everyone's planning to go back. So the work is there. It's just a matter of when. And sadly, no one knows exactly when that is happening. But there is a lot of talk happening about shows going back the end of August. We did originally hear the end of July, and now it's been the end of August, just because of the second wave, while they try and get that back under control. And it's, you know, it is scary, and I understand with America it's all about insurance and things like that. It's very hard to say, to speculate what's going to happen. But I do feel like there's only so long that this industry can be on hold for. You know, like yourself, you're, you know, working and, you know.
Well, yes, I think our border back home is doing what it can to control the spread of anything. But inside, I think we're pretty good. This industry's back running now with Avatar and Lord of the Rings, and I think a few others that are creeping in now. We'll just wait and see. So how does a place like, from where you sit, these satellite film locations like Atlanta and those places, I mean, how much interest do they, do you find people are going to those areas as well to break away from LA? Does it still hold the Hollywood dream for some, or does Atlanta present some of that now?
To be honest, I am considering moving to Atlanta, depending on what happens with all of this. It is like the new Hollywood. There's a lot of work in Atlanta. It's crazy. But you know what? LA is still the dream. It very much is. It still has these amazing studios that if you ever get to work on, I worked on Paramount a few times. And when you walk onto that stage, that studio, it is amazing. You definitely do feel like you're, you know, I still get excited. I'm still very much, as soon as I walk onto Paramount, I'm always just like, huh, the little Kiwi girl who always wanted to be in America working gets very excited. And then I have to remind myself to be professional and a grown up. So it definitely still has some of the shine. Hollywood is definitely not what people expect it to be, but there are moments where it can. There are moments, you know, red carpets and you know, industry parties and stuff like that. For the most part, if you just take them for the fun that they're meant to be, they can be fantastic. But to be honest, as far as actual industry goes, these other locations are pulling a lot of work, and their crews and the people who are there are so amazing at what they do. Almost everyone who I know from the stunt industry who's in Atlanta originated in LA, and they've moved, and wow, they're killing it. So it is, yeah, it's definitely a big draw card.
So I'm just going to go a little bit deeper here. Mm-hmm. Going to LA, obviously something you planned. I could see that was in the dream earlier on. Yeah. Now that you're here and you're starting to see things unfold, where do you kind of see yourself in about, you know, let's just throw a number on it, 10 years? I mean, ooh, you know, I mean, yeah, no, it's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
With what you know right now, with what you know and what you're capable of and what these doors that are opening, I mean, can you see down that, a little bit down that tunnel?
No. The one thing that I've learned from, I guess, my time here is that it's very interesting. When I was in New Zealand, I had sort of a plan for life and things that I wanted to do, but little did I know that this opportunity was going to present itself. And I gave up a lot to move over here. Moving forward, I'm still very much on the mindset of, if I can pay my bills doing what I love, if I can walk onto set in the morning and, you know, be in my trailer when they come knocking, going, hair and makeup's ready for you, and you're like mid sip of coffee, you've only taken one bite of your breakfast, and you roll your eyes, and then I remember how freaking grateful that I am to be there, and I'm like, sure, I, you know, as long as I can bring my coffee with me. I'm still of that mindset of, if I can work enough to pay my bills, even in 10 years time, I think I would be very, very happy with that. In saying that, the one thing that I would like to do is, I think that I would like to increase my likelihood of, rather than it being kind of like throw a dart and that hope you get work, you know, maybe a couple of times this year, I would like to, you know, feel secure enough to know that I am going to, that I can count on it, that I can bet on myself, because I've created those friendships, relationships, and I've proven myself every single time I go to work, not just once, every time. Every day that I go into work, I feel like I need to prove myself, not because anyone else makes me feel that way, because I've got to prove it to myself that this is what I want to do and that I'm passionate about it. But I also, I definitely am grateful that I've had more acting work come up, but I'm still young enough to be able to blend the two. So I feel very excited about, you know, now being part of the Marvel family a little bit, just because I've had the opportunity to audition for one of the other shows as a stunt actor. They wanted actors for these roles. Granted, I wasn't quite what they were looking for, which is fine, but to have those opportunities now present itself, I just want to make sure I take every opportunity and make the most of it. 10 years time, it is possible and likely, but I will not set it in stone, that I will still be living in America. I hope, there is a part of me that goes, it's likely, and I hope to have maybe bought a house in Atlanta, which would be a huge stepping stone to actually own a house. And to be able to do that while working, and still, for me, anytime I work, is actually living the dream. So that's 10 years from now, I don't know, maybe that. And who knows, you know, it's not like, I think we discussed earlier on when we first started chatting about doing this interview, coordinating is a much bigger job than I think people think it is. And I still feel like I need a lot more experience watching behind the scenes before I could ever consider, because people were like, well, you know, do you want to be a coordinator? I'm like, I'm probably more likely to be a director of actors. But to be honest, it's not completely out of my head, because you have to look further in the future as you get older. You know, as much as I want to be able to hit the ground for as long as I can because it's fun, I also sort of realize that there are things, that stepping stones that you can work towards. And I've never been one to not strive for bigger and better things. So, yeah. In other words, I really don't know, but I'm going to keep going.
Absolutely. Way. Good stuff. Hey, you know, we've been going for quite a while now, which is great. And look, as we head towards the end of our, this talk, really interested in what is your routine like, generally, like on a day, and what does one do in LA? I mean, this is your job. It's you know, how does it work? You know, you're a trainer and you love coffee.
Oh, and my margarita. Also, well, right?
So what does your day look like, or your week? And you know, when you've done hustling and you're waiting for the phone call, you're training, obviously. And what other things does one do in LA?
This city is, everyone who comes here will probably tell the same story, which is this city can suck time. It is very, very interesting. When I was in New Zealand and I was working and I was personal training, I was a Les Mills trainer, and I was running a business with my fiance. We were running a male strip club. That's a whole nother story. You know, I could equate my day to 70 emails sent to people running the when we were running the club. I saw 6 clients. One of them lost, you know, this amount of body fat, and one of them achieved a goal somewhere else. And I could list academically what I had done. And then you get to LA, and some weeks, besides going to the gym or working out one way or another, there's an amazing facility called JAM, which is Joining All Movement, which one of my friends, Aaron, is the owner of, and he's working on Falcon and the Winter Soldier as well. He owns that gym. It's a stunt training facility. There is a whole lot of those that people can go and train, but you know, you lose on, not right now in COVID, but you know, it's an hour and a half in traffic each way. And then you train in the middle of the day, and then you go and have lunch with everyone. Your whole day is then gone. And it's amazing how much time gets sucked out of your life. So you really have to work to stay focused and be able to do something with your time that doesn't just involve waking up, doing a workout and going to sleep, which I have to be honest, that is really what my days are right now during quarantine, especially because I do have a job to go back to. So if we test positive, when we're meant to get on a flight and go back to Prague to finish what we're shooting, we get replaced by someone else. And I cannot afford for that to happen. I didn't come this far to lose my job. So me leaving the house is a very, very rare occasion. So it is a lot of waking up, reading a book, make sure I read a little bit, try not to spend too much time on social media, make sure I get my workouts in. You know, I've put notes in my, for this week as well, I'll try and do something new. So right now I've got notes in my phone and my diary to be things that I want to learn, as I want to go online and learn some new sword flurries, because they've been seriously lacking, because I have not been doing a lot of sword work since my first year here in America, and then with all the Spartacus and all that sort of stuff, learning a lot of the sword stuff back then, and I haven't been keeping up with it. So this week is going online and learning some new sword flurries. And I want to learn how to twerk. I'm really productive like that. I don't know how people do it. So that is my personal thing that I want to learn how to do, because I've got a booty and I do not know what to do with it. So, you know, you find new things to keep yourself entertained. This is what COVID does to us. You know, so, you know, I could probably say something that sounds far more intellectual, like I've gone back to school or something, but oh, good God, no. No.
Wow. Hey, well, look, just quickly for those who are listening, and tell us three movies that is, what's three movies that you go back to in terms of that shaped you?
Oh, The Princess Bride.
Why?
It's got everything. It's got everything. You know how, and you know how people always say, and it's true, that's why there is a lot of ethnic diversity coming out and things like that. People want to see people who look like them. And I remember that Robin Wright Penn was Princess Buttercup, and I could see myself being that because she was savvy and actually, to be honest, I guarantee you, every movie that I will ever say that I liked, the thing that I liked about it is that the woman, that's why I love sci-fi. The woman characters, they get to be sexy, but they get to be strong. They get to be not just street smart, but they actually get to be intelligent. And usually they can kick some ass as well. And that is that thing that I love to see on screen, because it's something that I personally relate to and I would love to portray. Because I feel like there's a certain amount of, I'm just going to talk myself up right now. I feel like that's me in real life. I have book intelligence, street smarts, I can kick some ass, and I get to be a little bit sexy and fun as well. And I feel like every movie that I relate to like that, even things like, you know, Terminator with Sarah Connor, she gets to be sassy and kick ass. And then you get Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, whatever, all of them that go on. Those are movies that, and then in TV shows, things like Stargate, with Amanda Tapping, who played Samantha Carter. She was, you know, traveling to other worlds with, you know, all the boys, and she was always the smartest one there, as well as being able to shoot kick ass and all that sort of stuff. So, but The Princess Bride was probably my first one. Oh, and Red Sonja with Bridget Nielsen. My dad recorded it off TV. I was way too young to watch. I was about 8 years old, I think. My dad recorded it on TV, and I remember seeing that there was a videotape sitting in the video player. I'm old. And so I pushed the video in and hit play, and it had these priestesses getting slaughtered. And I went, I probably shouldn't be watching this, but I was fascinated, and I watched the entire thing. And then my dad came home and went, did you see there was a movie I recorded for you? I knew you'd love it. Best dad ever. But like Red Sonja was another one where she was as strong as the guys, and she was sassy, and, you know, she was masculine but yet still sexy. And so Red Sonja, Princess Bride, because, you know, who doesn't like a good princess love story that has Andre the Giant and sword fighting and brilliant writing and relatable characters, even if they're off in a fantasy world? That movie does not age either. And then you go into, as I got older, all the sci-fi, kick-ass, Ripley, you know, aliens. See, I could talk all day. Sorry.
No, one more movie. I didn't let you off. What's the third one?
I'm probably going to say the Aliens, I guess. So it would be Red Sonja, Princess Bride, and then probably Aliens, I guess. But I mean, there are so many of those, so many movies that sort of I attached to that I could go back and watch over and over and over again, for so many different reasons.
Well, I think it's an unfair question. I think I couldn't even do three. I think I'd probably need at least 15, I think, to.
Yeah, to I know. Like, picking three, it's a little hard, because then, you know, you can go into, you know, all different genres. Mm-hmm. and, you know, the incredible actors that are in, you know, these
and look at,
amazing.
You mentioned before, like, are you seeing the effects of diversity coming to the screen? Are you seeing like more opportunities arise for women, particularly stronger characters and those of color, minorities? Are you seeing that happening, bear fruit in the industry?
Yeah, I do think so. I think it's been happening for a while, because it was a few years ago when I first came to LA, and I remember laughing about it, because I've always been, like, I'm the product of a mixed race family, because I'm part Māori, part Rarotongan, even though I'm white. So when you look at me when I'm casting, I'm a white girl. I know that. But I'm very, very proud of my ethnic heritage. And I have a lot of black friends. I have a lot of people of color friends. And so it has been, I've been all for it. And especially when there are such specific stories to be told, there are black stories to be told. There are, you know, like we've got not enough, but we've got things like Whale Rider and things like that in New Zealand, which are our stories that we love and are passionate about. As far as now going into your more commercial side of things, with things like, you know, the big blockbusters and stuff like that, I do feel like they are starting to address the fact that diversity, ethnic diversity, hasn't been addressed the way it should do. There was a surge in it, and they started writing a little bit more for I digress. My personal thing that I found was when I first moved here and I started auditioning for roles, I remember ethnic diversity was coming, and I was just like, this is great, because they're going to be making the leads of these shows the dark girls, or the ethnic girls, or, you know, however you want to politically correct call them. And that probably means that the smaller roles, which is the stuff that I'm more likely to be going for, they're probably going to have white girls come in for those roles. So I was just like, this is awesome. Turns out that people would really all for the ethnic diversity, which I think is fantastic. But it sort of turned out that if the lead girl was a black girl, then the minor characters were going to be Indian and Asian and all that sort of stuff. And I was just like, I'm all for this, but can I get a job? Anyone? No? Okay. I'm still supporting. I am. I promise. But can I get a job? No? Okay. But I feel like right now with all of this going on, I think it's really necessary. I think people are now, companies and especially in our industry, are looking at themselves a little bit more. They are saying things like, if you've got black actors, you need to have a black makeup artist or a black hairstylist, because skin and hair are different and they need to be represented as such. Or someone who's just really well trained in those things. And I think it's gonna filter out. I think it's gonna filter through, I should say, not filter out, filter through. And I think it's going to create more work. Things are going to hopefully balance out as they should and start showing the world in the diverse nature that it really is. I think the Hollywood thing is, it's still very white. It is. It's still very white. But I feel like it's changing. Change takes time. But they've had a good amount of being slapped in the face by it. And the reality of the situation through sports, through TV and film, through big major companies that have made people look at themselves, their companies and all that sort of stuff and gone, it's not good enough. We didn't do enough. So I think it is happening. I think change is slow, but I don't think anyone's giving up on it anytime soon. And I think that's fantastic. And it also means maybe I can do a role in my actual accent rather than trying to do an American one. I'm just saying, because Kiwis do live in America. I think that's part of the issue that they're facing. I think that, because I've got a lot of black actor friends who I spend a lot of time with, and we've had these very serious discussions about it, not just, yeah, we're all for Black Lives Matters and stuff, because we are, we all are. I'm one of those advocates for it as well. But when it comes to the industry, that is where a serious concern comes in for the money people. There is demographic-wise, percentage-wise, of people of colour versus a white audience, it's a big percentage difference. And so it's trying to tell these stories in a way that feels like it can encompass the diverse world that we live in, not just telling black stories. That means, you know, the 65% of the audience isn't going to watch it because it doesn't relate to them. It's trying to find a way to, even though some of these stories need to be told because they're pieces of history that people are missing in the TV and film industry, it's also trying to find a way that it feels like it's open for everyone, that it's not just this audience that they're looking at. And I feel like when you say, is the audience ready for it? That is the debate. That is the money men side of when they're going to make these films or not. When they're deciding on whether they're going to, where they're going to put their money, their millions of dollars to make these things, is whether they're going to get the money back for it. And that is a bigger question for someone much smarter than myself. But I know that that is a serious concern. So it's finding the way to do that, that keeps the audience across the board interested. But then I also look at things like, you know, Once Were Warriors was huge around the world. And that was a New Zealand story that was brutal and heart-wrenching, and you know, it did really well around the world. So it's interesting the ones that do and the ones that don't, and for what reasons. So I think it's a matter of them, good writing, great actors, and how they promote it is gonna is gonna be the decider, I think, of how many of these diverse stories actually get told. And I'm all for it if they've got spaceships in them, because I'm a sci-fi geek. So.
Indeed.
Fucking what color you are, you're in space and you're fighting and it's cool. I want to see it. I don't care what, you know, nationality you are. Just make it cool.
Hey, well, look, well, that's just insane. Insanely awesome. And, well, look, I mean, we've been going now for an hour and, how fast that's gone, and you know, we should do this again, and you know, and just it's quite inspiring, really. And I look, and I've had questions for many young people, you know, do I need to make it to LA to make it a career? And it's really good to just to understand it's more than just a career, isn't it, from what I'm sensing from you going to LA. It was the dream, wasn't it, from a young age, you know? It's and like for me, the Kiwi dream was there.
Yeah,
sorry.
That's exactly it. I was just going to say that. It's just like, I honestly, there have been times that I've been here that I've regretted it, because the New Zealand TV and film industry is so amazing and there are so many opportunities. For me, this was a dream that I needed to pursue. But there have been times that not only have I just missed home, but I also have missed the opportunities that I know would have been in front of me if I was still there. But you know, I constantly say to people, well, you know, I made my bed, so now this is where I choose to lie in it. And that I need to, while I'm still getting these opportunities, I need to take them. But there are times that I go, I wonder what would have happened, even though I said I had to, if I hadn't have come here, I would have wondered why, what would have happened. It goes the other way as well. There are times that I do wonder if I had have stayed in New Zealand, what opportunities I may have had and where my life would be. So it can go both ways. You've got to figure out what's best for you and what path you want to take, and don't miss opportunities just because you think you should go to LA, or just because you, come to LA, but then you might miss out on something back home. You've just got to actually make the most of every opportunity in front of you and see where your story goes.
Wow. And that's a great way to end our evening. I see where that. The story goes. And yeah, it really is. So it's such a great way to end it. And see where the story goes. And look, and as you know, this is a new venture for me, starting podcasting. I'm really fascinated where it's going to go. And I feel like we've got a following already that, I've said to you before, you know, I went to China last year and I just coordinated the biggest show in China. And I could see the next 10 years clearly, you know, but there's this is my LA dream right now, is it's like, if I don't do this, you know, I'll have that regret. And hence why you and I are chatting the way we are right now. And sharing that. Yeah. Hey, well, look, thank you so much. And like I said, we'll do this again and keep us posted with how it goes back. If you go back to Germany, or was it Germany you were at?
No. We're in Prague. There are other shows that I know are in Germany right now. Like, I think Matrix is going there and stuff like that. So, wow. Information. So Prague, hopefully, fingers crossed, hopefully end of August. We'll see.
Absolutely. All right, Vanessa. Hey, well, thank you very much. And my best to you. And let's keep in touch. And people, if you on Instagram, Vanessa Cater, Cater. Mm-hmm. There you go. And add to that list and follow her journey. It's fascinating. Okay, thank you very much. Let's stop recording right now. Boom. Hey, well done.
Thank you.
That's so cool.
Sorry, I get carried away.
That was so good. That was really awesome. And, let me just stop recording. Oh, I'll record on it. Yeah, no, that was just brilliant. And, and like I said, we could just go on, we could keep going. And I think one of these things is that, like, hopefully, like, the audience will grow and, they'll come back and hear the next part.
Well, hopefully, there's more to talk about.
Oh, no. Undoubtedly there is. And I'm just finding, like, I'm learning so much through this process, just to go out there and ask the questions that I wish somebody asked me. And, just to think about it more deeper than just about the stunts. Because, when what's his name? Armstrong, the cyclist,
when he released
his book, he said, it's not about the bike. And I'm like, I completely understand that. It was, that's just the vehicle. That was just the vehicle that drove you. And, stunts to some extent is the vehicle, the film.
Yeah, industry. Sure. But I'm just, it's so awesome that you said when we were talking earlier on, and I forgot to, because you were in the middle of actually telling me, and I forgot to actually stop you and ask you, what was it that you did that you released that had all of those views? What was it you filmed? What was it that you filmed? When you were talking, when we were talking earlier on, you said that you had a, the original thing that you did, and you said you'd filmed something, and you were really, really nervous about putting it out.
Oh, yes. I had to grab my camera and do this. And talk to it and tell people that I was going to start a podcast. And I was like, that's just something I've never done. Speak to the camera and video myself and post it, just because anytime I've spoken to a camera I've been interviewed for a job or about a specific project. And I'm very aware of my image as a stunt coordinator and how I want to be perceived. And to some extent that's shaped the way I've been hired over the years. Yeah. And so now I'm getting into this territory of this new venture. It's like saying I'm going to be an actor now.
That was the thing that I was saying about the social media stuff, is that it's a tool, me doing this and talking to this on camera, like I do with my social media. That was what made Monique Ganderton say that she knew that I'd be able to act. She didn't look at my reel. She knew that I was a stunt performer and other people had recommended me to her before, but she'd never worked with me. But they said, well, we need someone who can act. And she said, it's really funny. She said her reaction to when they said, oh, we need someone who can act, she was like, oh no, this girl can act. She's never seen me act. It was purely because I'm this person on my social media. It's so interesting what people's perception of what you put out can come back to you to find out. So like when you're doing that and you're just being you and putting it out there, I guarantee you, that's exactly what's going to make people want to work with you even more, because they see what a really cool, open person that you are, and how, you know, you're, and how, you know, you're.
I was just getting to the good part. She was talking about me and I was, anyway, enough of that. We got cut out by some technology there, and what an amazing conversation and to have with her. And I'm super proud of one of our girls from New Zealand pursuing the dream, and looks like it's coming to fruition. And I want to catch up with her just post-COVID and the industry sort of find some normality again. So thanks for listening in. And that was Vanessa Cater. And one of those ordinary people that I know who's doing extraordinary things out there with her life. And well done. Catch you soon. Bye.